The Federal Bureau of Investigation is commonly thought of as America's police force, when actually, the FBI's primary mission is secret intelligence. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, my guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tim Weiner. We'll talk about his new book, Enemies, A History of the FBI. In it, Weiner sheds new light on the fascinating history of the FBI's 100-year war against anyone it deemed subversive, including American presidents. Then in the second half hour, we'll talk with Special Agent Jim McMillan of the FBI. McMillan lives in the Quad Cities. He'll tell us how he got into the career and about the fact and fiction of day-to-day work as an FBI agent. Inside the FBI, after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, Inside the FBI. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Special Agent Jim McMillan of the FBI. McMillan lives in the Quad Cities, and he'll tell us how he got into this career and about the fact and fiction of day-to-day work as an FBI special agent. My first guest this first half hour is Tim Weiner. Weiner's reporting on the Pentagon and the CIA won him the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. His new book is titled Enemies, A History of the FBI. This book sheds new light on the fascinating hidden history of the FBI's 100-year war against terrorists, spies, and anyone it deemed subversive, including American presidents. Tim Weiner joins us by phone. Good afternoon to you, Tim.
Hi, Ben.
In this book, you draw from thousands of recently classified documents, including J. Edgar Hoover's intelligence files, over 200 oral histories from FBI agents. What do you see as the most significant things these recently declassified documents reveal about the FBI that we didn't know before?
That the Bureau has been fighting terrorists since the turn of the 20th century, and that this is an incredibly complicated struggle, because every day the Bureau has to balance national security versus civil liberties. We want to be safe and we want to be free, and our Constitution commands that we have security and liberty, but these are opposing forces. And to try and prevent people from blowing up symbols of American power, and indeed Americans, while preserving the rights and freedoms that we hold dear, is a very complicated business. And that's what the Bureau has been up to since it was founded 104 years ago.
Where exactly do you see the most friction between the two concerns that you just mentioned? In what specific areas, when we look at the balance between civil liberties and protecting national security? Can you give us an example?
Sure. This is not law enforcement. This is not arresting bank robbers after the bank has been robbed. This is secret intelligence work. And over the decades, the Bureau has used the methods of secret intelligence, and they have included burglary, wiretapping, planting bugs in microphones, stealing people's documents from their homes and offices in order to prevent terrorists from striking before they strike. Our Fourth Amendment in the Bill of Rights protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures and warrantless searches and seizures. The technology for seizing information off of your computer, off of your cell phones, listening in through electronic eavesdropping, has always outstripped policy. And trying to get this right so that we have our freedoms and we are safe from attack is a very delicate balance.
When you look,
I'll give you a fine example.
Please do.
Just 8 years ago, the director of the FBI, the present director, Bob Mueller, had to confront President Bush one-on-one in the Oval Office over the illegal and unconstitutional aspects of the electronic eavesdropping program that the president had instituted after 9/11. And the FBI director, Mr. Mueller, said to the president of the United States, listen, you have to limit this and skin it back until it is within the boundaries of the law, or I'm going to resign. Now, we know what happened because Mueller took contemporaneous notes and Bush recorded this in his memoir. President Bush thought, oh my God, if the FBI director resigns, but secrecy prevents him from saying why, there's going to be a political massacre and I'm going to lose my presidency. So that's one example among many in enemies of where the rule of law confronts the power of the president and the FBI to spy on Americans.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the relationship between the FBI and presidents throughout the decades, what do you see, a consistent relationship, a consistent way presidents tend to treat the FBI, or perhaps are, in J. Edgar Hoover's case, perhaps a bit afraid of the FBI?
Well, there's J. Edgar Hoover and then there's everybody else when it comes to the power of presidents to spy on Americans. Hoover, as you know, ruled the FBI single-handedly for 48 years, from 1924 until the day he died 40 years ago in 1972. And Hoover was often more powerful than the presidents he served in the realm of secret intelligence and the control of secret information. You have examples throughout history of the history of the FBI where the Bureau is confronting the president over the Bureau's power to spy and the president's power to stretch and bend and break the law. And the great example of that, again, happened 40 years ago when Richard Nixon and his team of burglars I'm on an interstate, and that was a tractor trailer truck going by.
Okay.
When Richard Nixon and his team of burglars broke into the Watergate offices of the Democratic National Committee 40 years ago this month, J. Edgar Hoover just died 6 weeks before, and Hoover had begun to say no to President Nixon when Nixon ordered the Bureau to wiretap, to break into people's homes in the name of national security. This was a very, very difficult confrontation that ended with the FBI investigating the President of the United States and bringing him down.
You write that J. Edgar Hoover, quote, stands at the center of the American century like a statue encrusted in grime, but that his loyalists and opponents saw him in very different ways, and that, as you write, millions of Americans today know him only as a caricature, a tyrant in a tutu, a cross-dressing crank. None of that is true, you say. Before you describe what you see as the true picture of J. Edgar Hoover, tell us, first, how did the loyalists see him?
As the one man who stood between us and a communist subversion of the United States and its government, as a pillar of the law, as the man who led the war on communism in this country from the 20s into, through the height of the Cold War for half a century.
And then the opponents?
As a danger to the American government and the American people himself, who amassed so much power that he could not be controlled by presidents, Congress, or the Supreme Court.
And what would you say is the true picture of J. Edgar Hoover?
That he was both. He was not a monster. He was not a tyrant, but he was our Machiavelli, and he did amass an almost unbelievable amount of power. He was, among other things, the greatest bureaucrat of the 20th century, and bureaucrats amass power by building pyramids of paper and information, and by using powers granted them by presidents to serve those presidents, or in Hoover's case, serve what he believed was the higher interest of American national security.
What do you see as the FBI's greatest achievements, perhaps in J. Edgar Hoover's reign?
Well, I think it came in 1964 when the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, who was deeply concerned with American communism and with the growing anti-war movement and the rise of the left in America in the 1960s, ordered Hoover to destroy the Ku Klux Klan, which he saw as a very dangerous terrorist organization, which it was. It was the most deadly and violent terrorist organization in the United States in the 20th century. Well, Hoover didn't want to do that. He thought the problem of the civil rights era wasn't the segregationists. He thought the problem was the integrationists. He hated Martin Luther King. But his president ordered him to do so, to destroy the Klan. And he did. And within 3 years, the Klan was broken like a dry twig. The methods were brutal. They were sometimes illegal. But that was the most effective crushing of a terrorist organization in the 20th century in the United States.
For instance, what brutal methods to crush the Ku Klux Klan?
Well, under the broad category of dirty tricks, setting people against each other, sending poison pen letters to Klansmen, sending anonymous notes to their wives, saying, oh, I wonder who's peeking under your husband's robe tonight. Propaganda, you know, the whole panoply of dirty tricks that we would later associate with Watergate, trying to destroy people's lives, careers. It was brutal, but it was effective.
My guest, if you've just joined us, is Tim Weiner. Weiner is a Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award winner. His new book is titled Enemies, A History of the FBI. You also point to one of the FBI's greatest achievements in the 1950s, the FBI doing something really almost inconceivable at the time, placing a spy inside the highest councils of the Soviet Union. And that's something that neither the CIA nor the American military had accomplished. Tell us about that.
Well, that's correct. In the 1950s, the Hoover and the FBI instituted a program to try and recruit top-level members of the Communist Party of the United States as informants. And their most successful recruit was a disaffected former senior member of the American Communist Party, a guy named Morris Childs, who had been born in Russia, spoke Russian, and who had been a big wheel in the American Communist Party in the 30s and 40s, and then became disaffected and dropped out. Well, they recruited Morris Childs to be a secret communist for the FBI. Childs rejoined the party, became its foreign secretary, and beginning in 1958, undertook the first of more than 50 trips to the Soviet Union, to communist China, to the capitals of world communism, as the essentially the foreign secretary of the Communist Party of the United States, as their representative abroad. And he brought back intelligence about what the communist leaders of the world were really thinking and doing. He met with Chairman Mao, he met with Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet ruler, he met with the head of the Cuban Communist Party, and this was intelligence that was more precious than rubies, about what these guys actually did and thought behind the Iron Curtain. This was probably the greatest espionage operation of the 20th century in the United States.
On the other end of the spectrum, you also point to astounding incompetence. What story can you tell us that would point that out?
Well, those of your listeners with long memories and long lives will remember that during the 60s and 70s and the late 60s, there arose a violent wing of the American left called the Weathermen, who, among other things, planted bombs in the Capitol and the Pentagon. And they were a small group, fewer than 100 core members, but they literally drove the government of the United States out of its mind with fear and rage. In fact, senior members of the FBI, including the man who we all know as Deep Throat, Mark Felt, who was Hoover's number two at the time of Hoover's death, were later convicted of violating the civil rights of Americans for the illegal searches and seizures they executed against the Weather Underground. The Weather Underground carried out 38 significant bombings in this country during the early 1970s. The FBI solved none.
Why was that?
Because they had no intelligence on the left. They had no ability to infiltrate the left. You know, their ranks were 99.94% guys with crew cuts and ties.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't get intelligence on these people. They couldn't infiltrate them. They were unable to gather intelligence through legal means. So they used illegal means and tarnished the name of the FBI by acting as a secret police, like the East German Stasi, stealing people's personal effects, breaking into the homes of friends and families of these underground leftists. And, the result was a series of indictments against the senior leadership of the FBI after Hoover's death that really crippled the Bureau for years. And that was a self-inflicted wound.
To what degree was the FBI in any way to blame for failing to stop the 9/11 attacks?
Well, that was a failure of the entire American government, from the Federal Aviation Administration to the FBI to the CIA to the immigration authorities. It was a systemic failure of American government because we knew these guys had declared war on the United States, but we didn't know where and when the attack would come. The Bureau and the CIA, the FBI and the CIA, have to cooperate for American intelligence to succeed. The Bureau's jurisdiction is the United States and beyond, and the CIA's jurisdiction is foreign countries outside the United States. But they have to meet at that seam and cooperate and share information and work together. And throughout the history of the FBI and the CIA in the 20th century, second half of the 20th century, they did not do that. There are rare examples of cooperation, but they are few and far between. And when they wouldn't cooperate, they wouldn't share information. It was just like before Pearl Harbor, when the Army and the Navy and the FBI wouldn't share information. The result is a surprise attack. Since then, they have tried very hard to cooperate, because if we get hit again, all bets are off if we suffer a third Pearl Harbor in this country.
And yet, go ahead, sorry.
And so they know what the stakes are now, and everybody is trying to play on the same team. And a great deal of credit for the fact that we have not been attacked again since 9/11 in a serious way should go to Bob Mueller, the head of the FBI, who took office, God help him, on September 4, 2001, a week before the 9/11 attacks, and who is still there. And he has now served longer than any FBI director since Hoover. And he has done a very creditable job in trying to focus the collective mind of the FBI on global intelligence cooperation with the CIA and foreign intelligence services to prevent the next attack.
Tim Weiner, in just a few minutes, we'll talk with an active special agent of the FBI working here in the Midwest. In what way does his FBI, the way he works, differ from the way an agent would have worked 50 years ago in Hoover's time?
Well, it isn't Hoover's FBI anymore. It's a much more, and he'll tell you himself, it's a much more diverse bunch of people. It's not all, white guys with crew cuts and ties. The ability to speak foreign languages is greater. The understanding of international terrorism and the real threats to the United States, as opposed to people's ideology or people's words, as opposed to deeds, is greater. The challenge hasn't changed. There were then, 50 years ago, and there are now today, people out there who want to hurt us because we are the most powerful nation on earth and because our foreign policies enrage hundreds of millions of people around the planet. But in the heartland of the United States and in Manhattan, in New York, and in San Francisco, the job is essentially the same. What's going on out there? Who is trying to hurt us and why? And how can we help prevent them from succeeding?
And we'll hope that there's been a great deal of reform in the last 10 or 15 years in terms of FBI's technology. You write that the FBI remained a quote, pyramid of paper, mysteriously unable to create a decent computer system, and by the year 2000, you write, the average American teenager had more computer power than most FBI agents, and agents could not perform a Google search or send emails outside their offices.
Information technology has been a tremendous challenge for the FBI. And one reason is that, in a perfect information system, you want information to flow freely. But if you're dealing with secret information, you want that information compartmented and locked away. And they really hadn't figured out how to solve that rather difficult dilemma. They're working on it. But it's been an extraordinarily difficult problem, and hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, have been poured down a rat hole trying to solve that rather difficult dilemma. You know, let's not forget that the Bureau has to wear two hats. It is a secret intelligence service that deals in counterterrorism, counterespionage, but it is also a law enforcement agency, of course, and that's how most people know of it and think of it. So they have to, and have always had to, deal with white-collar crime and, you know, other violations of federal law. I think there are probably 3,000 federal statutes the FBI has to enforce, everything from, you know, terrorism to cattle rustling, if it's an interstate crime. And it's a tremendous challenge. You know, there's not more than 11,000 special agents in this country, and they've got a lot on their plate. But everybody knows what job one is since 9/11. Job one is to prevent the enemies of the United States from striking us where we live.
Tim Weiner, we have just over a minute left. I wanted to ask you about the FBI and popular culture and how it matches up with reality. There have, for instance, been many Hollywood portrayals of J. Edgar Hoover, the most recent called J. Edgar, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, directed by Clint Eastwood. How close did this film come to reality, you think?
Not at all. I mean, the idea that the repressed homosexuality of J. Edgar Hoover caused the Cold War, which is the theory of this movie, is a crock, to put it politely. You know, the caricature that Hoover was a secret homosexual who wore dresses and carried on a lifelong romantic relationship with his number two guy at the FBI, Clyde Tolson, is a myth that's been around since before World War II. And the rumor that Hoover was gay started in the late 30s when he started going after homosexuals in the government, which he did. He destroyed thousands of people, their careers and their lives, in and out of government because they were suspected of being gay. So that was sort of the blowback, or the moral consequence of that effort. But the idea that, you know, Hoover's repressed sexuality led to him lashing out against the American left, or, you know, American liberals, is a myth.
Well, I want to thank you very much for this conversation, Tim Weiner. Enemies, A History of the FBI is Tim Weiner's newest book. He's been reporting on the Pentagon and the CIA. In fact, that's won him a Pulitzer Prize, also a National Book Award. Joining us this afternoon live from New York, Tim Weiner, thank you for this conversation.
Ben, it's my pleasure. You take care.
You too. Coming up on River to River, when we return from a short break, we'll talk to a special agent, active now in the FBI, Jim McMillan. He lives in the Quad Cities. He'll tell us how he got into the career and about the fact and fiction of day-to-day work as an FBI special agent when we return here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And this hour, we are inside the FBI. My next guest is Jim McMillan. He is a special agent with the FBI in the FBI's Omaha division, which includes Iowa. He's also a resident of the Quad Cities and joins us by phone, Jim McMillan. Agent McMillan, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben. Nice to be with you today.
I want to talk a little bit about how you got into this career and about the fact and fiction of day-to-day work as an FBI agent. I understand, Jim, there's some things we obviously can't talk about, current cases, correct?
That's right.
You've been with the FBI for about 10 years. Describe your current position as a special agent and its responsibilities.
Well, as a special agent with the FBI, I'm responsible for investigating the wide variety of federal offenses that may occur in our territory. And specific to my job over here in the Quad Cities, I cover three counties on the eastern part of Iowa, Scott, Clinton, and Muscatine County. Being such a small office and covering a relatively small area, the three counties, you are tasked with a wide variety of duties and investigative responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about cases you may have taken on in those three counties in the past years that are now closed that you're able to talk about?
Well, it really, there's such a wide variety of things when you're in a small office like this. I've investigated everything from large mortgage fraud schemes to child exploitation matters, kidnappings, bank robberies, you name it, we've pretty much done it over here.
Mm-hmm. So describe a typical day's work for you.
Well, that's the great thing about being a special agent with the FBI is there's really no such thing as a typical day. One day you could be out responding to a traditional crime like a bank robbery. The next day you may be out doing surveillance on a national security type case like a counterterrorism case or an espionage case. And then the next day after that, you may be stuck in the office for a day or two reviewing boxes and boxes of financial documents related to a white-collar crime case.
Okay.
So no 2 days are really the same.
River to River listeners, do you have a question for our FBI special agent on the program for this half hour? Jim McMillan is with us. If you have a question or a comment for him, please join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. So you just described a typical day. Describe an exceptional day that is in your memory over the last decade of working with the FBI.
Well, one thing I can think of is an investigation that was initiated a number of years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, involving a company by the name of Henry's Turkey Service in Attalissa, Iowa. And this is a case that garnered quite a bit of attention in Des Moines. There were several articles in the Des Moines Register written about it. And this involved a bunkhouse that was operating in Attalissa, Iowa, and they were housing about 20 or so mentally disabled men there who were being employed at a local meat processing plant. And this case was initially investigated by the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, and they had responded out there based on a complaint of concerns about financial exploitation and about the physical safety of these men. The DCI requested our assistance in coming out because the burden on their agency was probably going to be a little too great with that number of potential victims. We had more than 20 men out there. We responded out there and obtained emergency funding and worked with the Iowa Department of Human Services and several other state and local and federal agencies to find placement to ensure the safety of these men. The federal investigation ensued following the initial response. The bunkhouse in Attalissa was eventually closed. And a Department of Labor investigation resulted in over $1 million in penalties to Henry's Turkey Service for the financial exploitation of these men.
And for you personally, Agent McMillan, that was satisfying. Why? That work,
well,
that particular case?
The bottom line with our agency, and this is one of the misconceptions of the FBI, and I think law enforcement in general, is that people believe that people get into law enforcement because they want to put people in jail. Well, the reason the vast majority of law enforcement officers, and I can certainly speak for myself as an FBI agent, the reason I do this job is to help the victims. And so at the end of the day, in this case involving these men that were working at this processing plant and receiving a substandard wage for doing that, at the end of the day, their safety and their well-being was the most important thing to me, and that's what I found so personally satisfying about it.
I see on your resume you have a BA, BS in psychology from the University of Iowa in Iowa City, also an MA in clinical psychology from Middle Tennessee State University. Did you pursue those degrees thinking they would be helpful for the FBI?
Not necessarily. As Mr. Weiner suggested in the first half of the program, our agent population is very diverse, but I didn't pursue that line of education specifically to join the FBI, although that's eventually where I ended up.
Did that come in handy in your work, though?
It does, especially in one of my collateral duties, which is acting as a crisis negotiator for the FBI.
Oh, I see. So in working for the FBI, what sort of training do you get as an agent that is really key to your operations?
Well, following the recruitment process to become an FBI special agent, which can be quite lengthy and is challenging in and of itself, every FBI agent has to attend the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. Now, when I went through that academy now 10 years ago, that was a 16-week program. Now I believe it's 21 or 22 weeks. And so you get comprehensive training in investigations, law, physical tactics, and things of that nature over that period that is attempting to prepare you for what you're going to face in the field.
Mm-hmm. Other situations, types of combat situations?
Potentially there are. Anytime you are faced with having to take someone into custody and you're going to restrict their freedom, there's always the potential for violence or conflict. And so in preparation for those instances, we complete training appropriate to those situations.
Special FBI agent Jim McMillan is with us for this half hour. If you have a question for Jim McMillan, please join us, 1-866-780-9100, or send us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. In the decade or so that you've been in the FBI, how much has technology changed your work?
It has changed quite a bit, although I have to say that advances in technology don't really change the way we do our job so much, because the key to being an FBI agent is gaining intelligence and information from people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the best way to do that is to engage in conversations or interviews with people. And no matter what the technological advances are, that's always going to be the baseline for our job. It's going to be, how do you relate to another person? How do you develop and elicit information from that person?
Mm-hmm. So when we look at a toys department and we look for toys that have to do with the FBI, the spy kits, the ingenious things, they have nothing whatsoever to do with the reality of being an FBI agent, or very little. Do you have such things?
Well, there is a place for those technological devices in the FBI. I don't want to suggest that. And certainly the FBI does employ sophisticated technological means to carry out our mission. You know, are we issued X-ray glasses and wiretapping kits? No.
Okay.
But we will utilize sensitive technological means when the time is appropriate to the investigation.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about any important tools as an agent? You have some, obviously, I imagine you can't tell us about. What do you rely on that we might rely on in our work?
Well, it's we possess the tools that any law enforcement officer possesses. Obviously, we're armed, so each agent carries a handgun. Each agent is issued handcuffs and other defensive tactics type things. But outside of that, there isn't really anything special, or there's no super secret spy kit that were issued to carry around in our car. It's pretty much a traditional law enforcement job.
As you heard in the discussion with Tim Weiner earlier in the hour, the history of the FBI illustrates in detail the the struggle between national security on the one hand and protecting our civil liberties on the other. You are there to protect our national security as an FBI agent, and we want to keep our civil liberties intact as a free society. How much do you wrestle with that, any such questions at your level of day-to-day work as an agent?
Well, that's a very good question. And that's, I think, another one of the misconceptions of the FBI that's kind of propagated by television shows and movies is that the FBI is out conducting indiscriminate wiretaps or surveillance of everyday citizens for some trivial reason. But I have to say that this is one of the primary concerns of the FBI, and something that's taken very seriously, is that all of our investigative efforts abide by guidelines that are set by the Attorney General and by internal FBI policy to protect the civil liberties of the citizens of the United States. So it's something that you have to consider in almost every case that we open. You know, we want to make sure that we're not investigating things solely based on First Amendment rights. We want to make sure that we are conducting searches and seizures in accordance with the Constitution of the United States and only when legally authorized to do so. So it's something that we deal with on a daily basis.
You mentioned surveillance. Drones have been a huge part of the war against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now there are predictions that multitudes of unmanned aircraft could be flying here in the U.S. within a decade, and that's raising a specter for some of a surveillance society in which no home or backyard would be off limits to prying eyes overhead. Or this would seem to be a natural tool for the FBI, wouldn't it?
Well, you would have to weigh the use of such technology with the civil liberties of the population. And so while it may be a good and valuable tool to use in the future, you'd have to evaluate it on a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. But having said that, we're almost to that point today. If anyone can log on to the Internet and access Google Maps, for example, and get a satellite view of their house,
right,
you can zoom it down right into your own backyard. So we're not far from that, I think.
Right, and they're developing drones or have sized developed drones the size of bugs that could fly into houses and provide intelligence.
I don't know of any such thing like that, and I think that the FBI would be very wary of employing that type of technology.
It's been more than a decade since the attack on 9/11. Were you an agent on 9/11?
I joined the FBI in February of 2002, so just shortly after.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an idea of how safe we are in the U.S. compared to before 9/11?
Well, it's difficult to assess the level of safety. I can only say that there are many, many threats against the United States on a daily basis. And that's one thing I think the public needs to understand, is that many of the things that are many of the threats that are mitigated by the intelligence community, not just the FBI, but the intelligence community as a whole, many of those threats are unreported because these are sensitive national security matters where secrecy is a necessity. And so it's difficult to say how safe we are. I can say that the intelligence community is doing its best to protect the United States every day.
Can you give us any idea of what you would see as the most likely form of a terrorist attack?
Yeah, I really wouldn't be able to speak to that.
Mm-hmm. So it's a very different organization. I realize you joined after 9/11, but Thomas Keene, he's a Republican chairman of the 9/11 Commission, concluded, in his words, that we can't continue in this country with an intelligence agency with the record of the FBI. He has a record, he said, of an agency that's failed and failed again and failed again and again. So this is, as we talked about in the first half hour, this is a very different FBI than we've had in past decades, you're saying.
Well, I don't know that I would agree with that in whole. And, you know, in Mr. Weiner's book, he cited kind of the infancy of the FBI and how it kind of grew out of investigations of terrorism and sedition and things like that, even going back to the German torpedoing of the Lusitania and how national sentiment kind of arose out of that, and the United States recognized that we needed some sort of investigative force to battle those types of things. And so since that time to the present, our goals remain the same, and that's to enforce the laws of the United States and to protect the national security. So to say that this is a much different agency, I would say maybe technologically that may be true, but our goals are the same. The dedication of the personnel is the same. So I don't really think it's that much different.
Special Agent Jim McMillan, you've mentioned a couple times in this conversation about misconceptions or myths. What about the idea of the FBI strong-arming the local sheriff, local authorities when it comes to law enforcement?
Yeah, I think that that's something that is propagated by movies and television. You know, I think I was kind of making a list of misconceptions prior to us speaking, and that was number one on the list was, you know, assertion of federal authority when dealing with the local authorities. And it's just not true, especially in a place like Iowa, where every agency, including the FBI, is a small agency. Even the urban police departments in Iowa don't have enough sworn law enforcement personnel to address all their needs. And so while there may be instances involving national security or espionage or things like that where secrecy is necessary, we still attempt to share as much information as we can. We try to include our state, local, and other federal law enforcement partners as much as we can, and we try to share as much information as possible. We try to cooperate as much as we can, especially in a small place like Iowa.
You have that list of misconceptions. Anything that you haven't mentioned that you would like to mention when you look down on that list?
Well, I think that we addressed part of it, but after 9/11, I think that there was a lot of reporting about the FBI not being interested in traditional criminal matters now, that the FBI was going to be the terrorism police. And I can say that that's really not the case. While counterterrorism and national security matters are at the top of our list, we are still tasked with enforcing the laws of the United States and protecting the population of the United States from becoming victims of crime.
Let's talk a little bit about career advice in the final minutes here. I have, for instance, a nephew interested in going into law enforcement, perhaps the FBI. What advice do you have for people interested in the FBI as a career?
Well, that's interesting because when I go to college career fairs and you talk to college students who say, I'd like to be an FBI agent, one of the first questions they ask is, should I change my major to criminal justice or should I become an accountant? Specifically to join the FBI. And the advice I always give is, no, study what you enjoy, because if you do something you enjoy, you're going to excel at that. And the people that are recruited to become FBI special agents are people that excel at their careers. The baseline requirement for being an FBI agent is a college degree and then 3 years of full-time work experience in any field. So if someone obtains a college degree in something they're interested in, they obtain full-time employment in a field they enjoy, they're going to excel in that field, and then that will increase their chances of being recruited by the FBI.
That's interesting that they can come from a wide variety of backgrounds. So what is the commonality? What types of people, what's the common ground that fits especially well into FBI culture and work among people?
Well, I think the real bottom line is patriotism, for one. Every FBI agent I've ever met is a fervent defender of the Constitution, is someone who cares greatly about service to the United States and cares about protecting the United States. So I think that's the real bottom line when you're talking about special agents of the FBI.
Special FBI Agent Jim McMillan, thank you for joining us this half hour. It's been a pleasure to get a glimpse into your day-to-day work and some of your insights. Thank you, Jim McMillan.
Thank you, Ben.
Tomorrow on this program, recently an Iowa man and his sons made a huge discovery on their Oskaloosa farm, the bone of a mammoth. Next time, tomorrow on River to River, we'll hear how scientists are in the process of excavating the skeleton of this extinct giant. We'll also find out why an 18-year-old Carroll, Iowa native woman, Ray Heim, is running across the U.S. That's right, across the U.S., coast to coast, tomorrow on this program. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.